artillery units carry out fresh attacks on the Gaza Strip, targeting two parts in the enclaves south and north. Brazil registers nearly 39,000 coronavirus cases and more than 1,000 fatalities in 24 hours. Welcome. Israeli forces have attacked Palestinian protesters outside the Old City of Jerusalem al-Quds for the third consecutive night. The Israeli regime forces used stun grenades and water cannons against the protesters, who hurled stones. Scuffles also occurred in the city's Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood. The Palestinian Red Crescent said at least 14 Palestinians were injured and 20 arrested in total. Around 300 Palestinians, including children, were injured during the previous nights of clashes, some hit by rubber bullets. Tensions have been mounting since the start of the holy month of Ramadan, when the Israeli regime imposed tight restrictions on Palestinian worshippers around the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound. Meanwhile, the regime's plan for evicting Palestinian families from their homes in the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood is further exacerbating tensions. Meanwhile, the UN Children's Fund says 29 Palestinian children, including a one-year-old, have been injured in attacks in the East Jerusalem Al-Quds. In a statement, UNICEF said some children were taken to hospital for treatment with injuries in the head and the spine. The UN Children's Agency added that it has received reports of Israeli forces hindering the work of medical staff. It called on Tel Aviv to allow the injured to be treated without restrictions. The statement said 8 Palestinian children were also arrested. The agency urged the Israeli authorities to refrain from using violence against children and release all the children detained. To get you some proper reaction to that story, I'm going to bring in activist and commentator Mr. Ryan Dawson, who joins us via Skype out of Osaka, Japan. Ryan Dawson, as always, it's good to see you and have you with us on the show. You just heard two stories that I read about the latest that is coming in from that part of the world. Your reaction to it?
I'm glad you mentioned some of the context there with the evictions and the violence of the Al-Aqsa Mosque. We have to point out when every time they talk about rubber bullets, we're really talking about rubber-coated steel bullets, and they often aim for the groin, the knees, and the eyes to purposely maim Palestinians, including children, even babies. A one-year-old was hit most recently. This is also coming on the backdrop. It's Ramadan, and Palestinians are celebrating Ramadan, and Israel intentionally closed down the most popular gathering places and the most popular mosque, which they know predictably is going to agitate and incite violence. They murdered a 16-year-old boy, shooting him in the back, of the pelvis. His name was Saeed Oda. And they shot his friend who was with him as well. The friend who was shot had to run for cover, couldn't stay to help his dying friend. And the Israelis dragged his body toward themselves and held him there, bleeding out for 15 minutes before the Red Crescent was allowed to get to him. And so he died. And they murdered a 60-year-old woman in the same day. And she was innocent as well. So this is coming after all of that. Then they attacked Al-Aqsa Mosque, and they shut down the popular gathering spots for Ramadan. And over 136 people were injured in those conflicts. 83 went to the hospital, and there have been reports that they have been preventing treatment for the wounded, delaying ambulances, the typical things that Israel does. They murder children. They do it in Gaza. They do it in the West Bank. They recently bombed Latakia in Syria and killed a man and injured a child. They routinely detain Palestinian children in their prisons. It is something else for the UN to have to beg for a state to not commit violent acts to children. And by children, we mean toddlers too, babies. There's no line, and there's no media coverage of this in the United States, which is the principal giver of aid to the Israeli state. They wouldn't be able to exist without it. They rely on billions in foreign aid, and yet the public is unaware of all of the torture and murder that the Israeli state routinely does to children. The house evictions are based on what? Because they decided that all of Jerusalem belongs to them, and they're just going to kick people out of private property, make some flimsy excuse like God gave it to me, and they're stealing apartments. If they can't outright take them, they bulldoze them down, like in the West Bank. And when's it going to stop?
Yes.
And what are Palestinians supposed to do? All these international organizations just talk, and there's nothing ever done about it.
How justifiable is that, Ryan Dawson? You know, I was just going to add to what you say, you know, about killing children and all. I mean, we can trace that back to Sabra and Shatila. There is a long history of that. But the fact of the matter is that, Mr. Dawson, I think when you are up against resistance forces, you know, just bearing in mind that they are also fighting for something that they feel they have the right for, you think that there is a military up against a resistance force and there is tit-for-tat action. But when children are killed or are detained, it's not as if you can sit silent and do nothing. I wonder, Mr. Dawson, that why is it that we're not talking about fighters or resistance forces here? Why is it that, you know, some days have passed since the recent surge in these attacks, yet we don't hear anything whatsoever from the international community? And you know, by international community, I mean the sections that really matter, to not to let Israel to get away with that with impunity.
Well, if you talk about it on social media, you'll be banned for hate speech. Mm-hmm. Because they brand anything that Zionist regime does gets conflated as anti-Semitism, which is ridiculous. And it's not tit for tat. People don't understand the situation. They think, well, Palestinians are doing this, the Israelis do this, and they're reacting back and forth to each other. All of this violence is occurring in Palestine or in military checkpoints. Israeli children in Israel proper aren't being killed or targeted. This is an occupation. There's a blockade on Gaza. There's the annexation. It's not really an occupation, it's annexation. Let's call it what it really is, in the West Bank. They're stealing private property. They built a wall that's not even on their border, beyond their border, so that they could annex the territory between the demarcation line and the wall that they've built. They're routinely doing violence, and they allow settlers to burn crops and dump their trash on people and harass and bully people, shoot up their houses. And the moment a Palestinian stands up for himself and fights back, then the IDF or the police come in and arrest him. And you're seeing a lot of that in the United States right now, where Antifa, Black Lives Matter, they can go and burn cities, loot stores. The moment somebody defends themselves, that person goes to jail, where the people that started the violence do not. They get a pass. It's anarcho-tyranny. The state protects one class of people and not another. The reason it's not in the media in a lot of Western nations that are giving Israel money is pretty simple. They have a parasitic lobby that either bribes or blackmails its way into power. They get billions of dollars in aid, and they recycle a portion of that back on lobbying Congress, for example, in the United States. There are a lot of Jewish voters, and there are a lot of donors, the donor class, that donate on the Israeli side and not on the Palestinian side. Palestine doesn't have a massive lobby, and Israel does. And politicians don't possess a moral compass. They go where they're money goes, and they go as careers what they think will generate them the most votes. And it's really hard in America right now, because of identity politics, to point out the blatant racism and the occupation, annexation, violence, torture, the way the whole history of how that state was created on top of another state. You can't mention it, because there is this idea stemming from World War II and the Holocaust, that which Palestine had nothing to do with. Jews are always the victim, and they don't make a difference between Zionism, which is a political ideology, and Judaism, which is a religion, or Jewishness, which is an ethnic group. It's just all one thing to them. And so any assault on Zionism, doesn't matter how true it is, mm-hmm. doesn't matter how violent it is, they take that as an attack on Jewishness itself, and that's the only weapon you need in America. If you yell racism, ism, sexism, xenophobia, some sort of identitarian nonsense, the argument shut down. You know, the opposing side is just a bunch of Nazis and doesn't get to speak. So nobody can advocate for Palestinians without being labeled a racist. And it's so backwards, because the Zionists are, it is intrinsically racist what they're doing to Palestinians. And they punish Palestinians collectively. These aren't soldiers fighting soldiers. Israel has bombed universities, they bomb agricultural centers, they attack kindergartens, they kill people sleeping in their beds in their homes, they bomb residential areas, and then they just say human shield and no one looks at it. We cannot fix this issue without fixing the media, and Americans especially, also the British, the French, the places with the most money need to speak up about this. Neutral areas like Japan, they have a lot, could do a lot, and they do nothing. Mm-hmm. But it all really is because of the power of the United States and the U.S. money, and the U.S. is firmly on the side of Zionism, partly because of the bribery and also because of a lot of Christian identify stronger with the Jewish religion than with Islam, even though that's not what's actually going on. We have a really big wall of ignorance to overcome, because once somebody does know the issue, can see the pictures, the suffering, and what's really happening, anybody from anywhere is going to sympathize with the Palestinians. Sure. Everyone that's ever been over there said there's only one side that fears the cameras, and that's the Israelis.
That's the Israelis, understandably. There was insight in what you say, Ryan Dawson. I really appreciate you sharing them with us. That's Mr. Dawson, activist and commentator in Osaka, Japan.
Thank you.
Positions belonging to Palestinian resistance movement Hamas have come under Israeli artillery fire in the Gaza Strip. A correspondent there, Ashraf Shannon, joined us earlier with more on the attack.
Israeli artillery attacked a Hamas security post in the southern Gaza Strip town of Rafah, destroying the security post completely, although no casualties were reported. And just about 15-20 minutes after that, the Israeli artillery also attacked a Hamas security post in northern Gaza. We're still waiting for the details of that recent attack on the northern Gaza Strip town of Beit Hanun. The Israeli attacks have been taking place on the Gaza Strip for the second day in a row, as Palestinians in Gaza have been protesting near the security fence in the east of the enclave, and also Palestinian resistance groups have fired at least two projectiles towards the Israeli regime to protest against the ongoing attacks on the occupied East Jerusalem al-Quds, and the attacks on the brethren in the occupied city, and also the attacks on the Al-Aqsa Mosque and the Aqsa Mosque compound in Jerusalem.
Brazilian officials report nearly 39,000 new confirmed COVID-19 cases, pushing the country's total to nearly 15.2 million. Brazilian health authorities also registered over 1,000 new fatalities, taking the death toll to over 422,000. The country remains the world's second largest or second worst hit by the pandemic in terms of fatalities. Elsewhere in Latin America, Mexico reported over 1,100 new confirmed coronavirus cases and dozens of deaths. The country's total number of cases now nears 2.4 million, with almost 219,000 fatalities. Separate government data published in March, however, suggested the real death toll may be at least 60% above the confirmed figure. The director of the U.S. National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases says it is highly likely that health officials have been undercounting the number of fatalities from the coronavirus. Anthony Fauci, his remarks comes after a new report from the University of Washington estimated the U.S. death toll to be nearly double what's been registered so far. The analysis by the Institute for Health Metrics and Evaluation pegs the number of fatalities at more than 900,000. This is while the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention has put its latest official estimate at over 578,000 deaths. Authorities in the world's worst-hit country by the COVID-19 pandemic have also so far recorded more than 32 million confirmed cases of the virus. The U.S. is in shock again after another shooting incident, this time in the state of Colorado. In the city of Colorado Springs, a man attacked a birthday party, killing six people and then himself. Police have not released details about the perpetrator, except that he knew at least one of the people in the party. The incident comes a day after a deadly shooting in Maryland and another incident where three people, including a young child, were shot and wounded in New York City. Last year alone, 43,000 gun-related deaths occurred in the U.S., including suicides. President Joe Biden has slammed gun violence in the country as an international embarrassment. Russian President Vladimir Putin has vowed that his country will firmly defend national interests at a time of soaring tensions between Moscow and the West. He made the remarks in an address to a ceremony marking the 76th anniversary of the victory in World War II. Marina Kurtunova is in Moscow.
Russian President Vladimir Putin said that Moscow consistently defends international law and at the same time will firmly defend its national interests to ensure the safety of its people. He made the remarks during a speech to thousands of soldiers and veterans on Red Square during the annual parade, which marked the 76th anniversary of victory in the World War II.
Our people know too well how this can end. Russia is consistently defending international law while continuing to protect our national interests and the security of our people. Our guarantees are the glorious Russian armed forces, descendants of the victorious troops, and of course our joint efforts for the sake of our country's development and the well-being of Russian families.
Vladimir Putin voiced concern over what he described as a creeping return of ideologies of the time when slogans of racial and national superiority, of anti-Semitism and Russophobia became even more cynical.
Unfortunately, attempts are made to deploy a large part of Nazi ideology and the ideas of those who were obsessed with the delusional theory of their own supremacy. This ideology is not only supported by radicals and international terrorist groups of all kinds.
The parade was participated by more than 12,000 troops, 191 units of military ground equipment and 76 planes and helicopters. Military parades and festive events commemorating the Soviet victory took place in almost all Russian cities.
I consider the Victory Day as the greatest holiday of Russia. Many Russians lost their life to liberate Europe. Victory is victory, and it was very, very difficult. This is a great day for the Soviet people. Our republics of the Soviet Union won a great victory. Some powers are seeking to distort history. They say that the victory was won by the Americans, French, or Britons. It's a lie.
This year's parade comes at a time when Moscow's relations with the West are severely strained over a host of issues, including the situation in Ukraine and the imprisonment of opposition figure Alexei Navalny. Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov warned last week that relations between the Kremlin and Washington could plunge to the Cold War level if Washington continued to reject a dialogue with Moscow.
The Soviet Union lost about 27 million people, 40% of all human losses in the World War II. A significant part fell on the civilian population of the country. According to the Soviet Extraordinary State Commission for the Establishment and Investigation of the Atrocities of the German Fascist Invaders, about 2,000 cities and towns, over 70,000 villages in the USSR were completely or partially destroyed by the occupiers. Marina Kartunova, Moscow.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
in the limelight.
Funded largely through tax-deductible donations from the United States, Regavim petitions the Israeli regime to evict Palestinians under the guise of protecting the environment, says Jessica Boxbaum, journalist, in an article titled Regavim, Israeli regime faux environmental org converting U.S. donations into Palestinian evictions. Please stay tuned for the details. In the village of Khan al-Ahmar in the occupied West Bank, dozens of Bedouin families are at risk of losing their homes and becoming refugees again by July. While it is the Israeli regime military that is enacting the demolitions and evacuations, its efforts are largely driven by pro-settler nonprofits supported by American charities. While it is masked as an environmental organization, Regavim's work involves petitioning the Israeli regime to demolish structures and pursue evictions for Palestinians and Bedouins under the guise of protecting Israel's most precious and scarce resources, land reserves, water, air quality, though much of the organization's focus is on occupied Palestinian territory. Regavim's most recent targets have been the villages of Khan al-Ahmar and Susia, located in Area C of the West Bank, which is under total Israeli regime military control. The Zionist regime rarely approves building permits for the indigenous people in Area C, so the majority of Palestinian and Bedouin construction there is deemed illegal. In collaboration with nearly Israeli settlements, Regavim has petitioned the Zionist regime Supreme Court to demolish hundreds of buildings in Khan al-Ahmar since 2009. The regime has continuously delayed the displacement, causing Regavim to repeatedly file petitions in order to speed up the evacuation process, the most recent being filed in November 2020. In response to Regavim's latest petition, the High Court gave the state until July to demolish Khan al-Ahmar. Regavim did not respond to a request for comment. Regavim was founded in 2006 by Bezalel Smotrich, a former member of the Israeli regime's parliament and head of the religious Zionist party. Regavim has managed to make serious inroads into the Israeli political system, Kodi Orok, of the Good Shepherd Collective, a nonviolent grassroots resistance movement in the West Bank, said, referring to how Smotrich's political party was able to secure 6 seats in March election. The Israeli military has to respond to Israeli politics, Oroki continued. So having their co-founder now in the Knesset, they are able to put the sort of pressure on the Israeli military and on the Israeli civil administration to push these people off their land, he added. However, Regavim's ties to the regime don't stop with his founder. A 2018 Haaretz investigation found that the pro-settler group is financed by Israeli taxpayers through local settler councils, and it has collected taxpayer money from the United States. Regavim also has been able to exploit the U.S. 501 system to receive charitable donations to really engage in essentially what is ethnic cleansing of the land, Oroki said. Regavim is backed by tax-deductible donations from 3 New York-based nonprofits, including the Central Fund of Israel, One Israel Fund, and the Israel Independence Fund. According to the most recently available financial reports from Israel's Register of Associations, the Central Fund of Israel gave Regavim 1,804,175 shekels in 2019. Overall, Regavim received 319,603 shekels, almost $9,800 from abroad in 2019. Their Israeli donations amounted to 3,748,584 shekels, approximately $115 million. Hagit Ofron from Israeli Settlement Watchdog Group Peace Now said the lopsided ratio of donations could be because Regavim marks U.S.-based organizations' donations as Israelis when these donors have offices in the occupied Palestine. So the money comes from U.S. donors, but it goes through the Israeli office, so they can call it an Israeli donation, Ofron said. When probed by Haaretz in 2015 over the tax-exempt status of organizations funding settlements activity, the White House responded that the policy of every administration since 1967, Democrat and Republican alike, has been to object to Israeli settlement beyond the 1967 borders. Nonprofit donations in the U.S. are often shrouded in secrecy and lack transparency. Hala Ahmad, a policy analyst at Palestinian think tank Al-Shabaka, noted that this is due to minimal government oversight. If a nonprofit is given tax-exempt status by the U.S., you have organizations that could be complicit in human rights violations, Ahmad said. Regavim is just one organization among many that are party to this problem. The Central Fund of Israel and One Israel Fund did not respond to press inquiries, but the Israel Independence Fund denied that it's nonviolent with Regavim, violates international law and U.S. regulations, and referred to the Jewish people as the indigenous population of the West Bank, telling Min Press the IIF was, is, and will remain a proud supporter of Regavim. Several notable philanthropists have made sizable donations to these organizations, including the late casino magnate and Republican super donor Sheldon Adelson and the controversial Irving Moskowitz, who sought to use his wealth to create a Jewish majority in Arab neighborhoods of East Al-Quds. Funding of Israel's settler movement goes through a variety of channels and relies on a wide network of organizational and governmental support. Niamh Gordon, an Israeli professor at the Queen Mary University of London, has conducted research on Regavim, concluding that the use of nonprofits is just one part of the larger apartheid apparatus, explaining, in order to make a regime that is based on institutionalized discrimination and ethnic and racist identifications, you need to set in place a whole apparatus, and Regavim is an organ within civil society that enables apartheid. And whether these donors know what their money is being used for or not, Gordon emphasized that exposing them as apartheid enablers is crucial in dismantling the system.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Salamun alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. You're listening to the program Islamic Upbringing. In this program, we discuss problems and questions parents have regarding the Islamic upbringing of teenagers. And the answers are mostly based upon the Quran and the narrations of our beloved Imams alayhim as-salam. I'm Hasnain, and we have in the studio our guest speaker, Sheikh Farman Ali Ma'soumi. He's an Islamic researcher in the Hawdha Ilmiya Qom. Assalamu alaikum and welcome to the program, Brother Farman.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Dear audience, in the previous program, we're discussing about the different ways of respecting our teenagers. And we got to know that the different ways are like by doing salam and playing with them and calling them with good names and giving them importance at public gatherings. So, Brother Farman, can you tell us any more ways to respect our teenagers?
Yeah, definitely. Because we are showing some practical examples to our dear listeners regarding these issues. So we try always to give practical and easy examples how they can utilize them in their daily lives. Yeah.
Yeah.
We just do not show and tell them the ahadith, no, practical ways also. So one of the practical ways how to respect your teenager is if you are inviting, for example, to other, you know, you are inviting, you know, your relatives, your friends to your, you know, your marriage ceremony or any other function, especially separate invitation, you have to send separate invitation for their teenagers. Usually what we do, we write invitation card in a father and mother's name and finish, you know, which is common, you know.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, it's common.
They don't mind. They think that you have invited them. They, even their children will don't mind it, But if you send a separate card to
that's a huge respect,
which will have a huge, huge impact in their
life. That's right,
You know, when they see they have got a separate card, oh my God. You know, you keep yourself in the place of 13, 20, 12 years, 15, 16 years boy. Then you will know how much joy and respect you'll feel by seeing a small, you know, it is a small act. You know, you if you are sending one invitation, nowadays there are electronic cards. So there's no extra money for you also. Just, you know, one click, one tap more.
It can also be a message,
Just write their, you know, children's names, separate names, and you can write two, three their children's name and send one invitation. And you request your friends to do this same thing with you. You know, if you have a teenage boy or girl, you request them to write and send a separate invitation card for your children.
Okay.
And this will show them that they are respected. They have respect in their, you know, in others' heart for them. Even we can't imagine how much big an impact it will have on them.
That's right. It's very simple and easy.
Yeah, very simple and easy. Just we have to pay attention. We have to remind ourselves and our friends to do this, inshallah.
Inshallah.
Another way to show respect to your children is praise them in front of others. Whatever they have done, show their work in front of others and praise them. This will have also, again, huge, huge impact, and it will boost their, you know, moral and it will boost their, you know, in their respect also.
Thank you so much, Brother Farman. And dear audience, let's take a short break over here.
يا مقضي الخيرات The Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam said, honor your children and teach them good manners.
Welcome back to your audience, and before the break we were discussing about the another way of respecting our teenagers, which is praising them in front of others. Brother Farman, please continue.
Yeah, as I said, it will have a very, very huge impact in their life. Even we can't imagine how much big.
True.
Let me share about, myself.
Please.
An incident. When I was in class 6, in 6th class maybe, the children are 12, 13 years old. Maybe somehow less than.
Yeah, like 12 is around
12,
that.
13. So I was, 12 years of age.
Yeah.
So in my school, I had got the most marks in my school, in whole high school. You know, in subcontinent, they have from 6 to 10, they have high school. Yeah. In Iran, from 7 to 10. 12.
Yeah, 12.
So
yeah.
They have high school system. So I was in high school, and in annual result function, they announced that I have got the most marks.
Yeah,
so my brother, elder brother, is a teacher.
Yeah.
So in a very important meeting,
we
had some officers of, educational,
department. Yeah, educational ministers.
Not ministers, in educational department.
Ah, people from the department,
Department, like secretary or something else. But those were very important people. So in that gathering, my brother introduced me and told them that he has got this much marks and he has topped this school. So they gave me some prize, for example, that time 100 rupees or 50 rupees.
Yeah.
So I cannot forget this incident until now, how much big.
So there was a huge respect for
you. Huge respect.
True.
Was like flying. So this can have a very, very important impact in our teenagers' life. So
that's
praise them, but do not praise them a lot.
So
do
it can
not
spoil
exaggerate.
Them?
Yeah, it can have bad impacts also. It can spoil them also, but choose very, very good, important occasions and praise them.
We need to
work.
Be moderate.
Yeah, moderate. Another way is to listen to them carefully. This also shows that you are respecting your teenager. In so many programs, I have said that our Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa sallam was khayru udhun.
Yeah.
The most, the best listener on this earth, Rasulullah. When somebody would talk to Rasulullah, he would completely face towards him and
with full attention.
Full attention.
Yeah.
As if the speaker himself, he would think that he is 100% listening to me and he is paying respect and showing respect towards me.
Yeah.
So if you are listening to your teenagers, if they understand you are paying attention, then again this will show that you are respecting them. And they will understand definitely you are respecting them.
That's right.
And again, it will have, inshallah, very good impact in their life.
Thank you so much, Brother Farman. And your audience, let's take a short break over here.
When I was born, the first words that I had heard were the words of Allah being whispered through my ear. And as I felt Allah's presence in my soul, that day Islam took me in its fold.
Welcome back to your audience. And before the break, we were discussing about, the way of respecting our teenagers, which was listening to them carefully. Brother Farman, please continue.
Yeah, definitely being a human being, if you're talking to somebody and he's not paying attention to you, that we feel that he is betraying us somehow, So you never want to talk to him again. You do not want to respect him again because he's not listening to you.
Sure.
So if you listen carefully,
Yeah.
No matter whatever they are discussing,
mm-hmm.
unfortunately, parents, fathers and mothers, they straight away, they cut their, you know, talks.
Mm-hmm.
They don't listen to them and they say something else. No.
So it's like disrespecting the children.
Disrespecting
yeah.
the children.
Yeah.
No matter whatever he's talking, first listen to him completely.
Yeah.
Then you can give your own opinion about uh-huh. whatever he's demanding, whatever
right.
he's asking. So if you cut his talks,
uh-huh.
means you are disrespecting him.
True.
And if he understands that you are disrespecting him,
mm-hmm.
then definitely it will, you know,
it'll have a bad impact.
Bad impact, definitely.
Yeah.
Then he will also have the same, you know, reaction with you.
True.
And he will not also listen to you.
It will worsen up the things.
Worsen up the things, in, yeah, definitely. Yeah. So being a good listener, it is a very, very important skill.
Right. Yeah, true.
You know, skill. You have to train yourself up to listen.
And we need to learn that.
Yeah, even between husband and wife.
Yeah.
This is a very, very important and golden rule.
True. Yeah, that's
Everybody
right.
should utilize it in his
Inshallah.
Personal life. Another way to show respect to your children, your teenager, is you ask for his opinion.
Yeah.
Whenever you make any decision regarding your, you know, house, your any personal life, your social, any issue you want to make any decision,
uh-huh.
you ask for his opinion.
Uh-huh.
By asking his opinion, you are showing that he is very important to you.
True, that's right.
You are respecting
him. It'll make them
him.
Feel important.
Yeah, definitely, after 12 years, he's, you know, complete. Mostly he can give, he can share his ideas with you.
True.
Sometimes it can be, most of the times it can be helpful for you also.
True.
Yeah, but more than you, it is beneficial for him, for your son or daughter.
Right.
It can help them building you the inner confidence.
True, yeah.
If they have this confidence, inshallah, mm-hmm. they will be respectful towards you also in the future.
That's right, yeah.
So by sharing with them,
mm-hmm.
you know, asking them to share their opinions with you,
yeah.
you are giving this opportunity of, you know, feeling respectful.
Mm-hmm.
They will feel respectful.
True,
they
yeah.
will feel that they are very, very respectful towards you. And
right.
you are respecting them also.
Thank you so much, Brother Farman, for joining us. And thanks so much, dear audience, for staying with us. And in this program, we discuss about more different ways of respecting our teenagers. And we have said that one of the ways is giving them separate invitation, that whenever you invite the family to any gathering, so you need, if you give a special or separate invitation to the children, this will make them feel special and this will make them feel respected. And the other thing which we said was praise them in front of others. So like when we praise them in front of others, this thing will again make them feel special and important. So this is really important. So and the other thing which we said was listen to them carefully. As we said that Rasulullah sallallahu alaihi wasallam was the best listener. So we should learn from him and we should listen carefully to what children are trying to say us. So this will make them feel respected again. And the last one which we said was you know, asking their opinions. Like when there's any family discussion or anything, we should ask children their opinions. So this will make them feel important and this will boost their self-confidence and it will make them feel respected. Thank you so much, Brother Farman, and thank you so much to your audience for staying with us. And if you have any questions, comments or suggestions, please contact us at our email englishradio@irib.ir and visit us at our website parstoday.com. Until another program, fi amanullah.
Islam solves all of its problems. Allah leaves no stone unturned. Perfect with no flaws at all are the laws of Allah.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock,
for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,410 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz, every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat, or BAT 5, and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box 19395-6767 Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
In the limelight.
In Britain's long tradition of honoring a family which are the beneficiaries of a system which caused the death of millions in the name and cause of the empire, we now learn that Boris Johnson's government is set to purchase a yacht to honor Prince Philip, officially, of course, to carry out royal duties. I prepare for you an article written by Richard Sedan, a journalist, writer and television reporter. The piece is titled, £200 million for a yacht to honour Prince Philip. Britain has far more important priorities. Please stay with us for more of Richard Sedan's article. According to reports and news that the British government is planning an expenditure of £200 million of British taxpayer money to build a yacht to honour the late Prince Philip, while perhaps unsurprising, is still nonetheless shocking. While some people in Britain revere the royal family and mark the death of Prince Philip along with pro-royal outlets with a sombre tone, whitewashing the many comments he made during his life which cause offence to many, others found the coverage of his death and funeral beyond excessive, to say the least. But regardless, in Britain's long tradition of honouring a family which are the beneficiaries of a system which caused the death of millions of people in the name and cause of the empire, we now learn that Boris Johnson's government is set to purchase a yacht to honour Prince Philip, officially, of course, to carry out royal duties. The planned move is estimated to see the taxpayer foot a bill of approximately £200 million. The proposed yacht will bear Prince Philip's name and will be celebrated, uncritically, by supporters of the royal family in Britain. But the reality, however, is that this expensive gesture has been and will be interpreted as a colossal insult to those living in Britain who experience ongoing serious hardship in their lives, struggling to make ends meet, and who may well as well inhabit an entirely different universe to the monumentally wealthy royal family. Over the next few years in Britain, especially under the government which Boris Johnson now leads, poverty has reached extremely high levels. Scores of people are forced to use food banks as a way of feeding themselves on a day-to-day basis. Food banks, whilst representing and being symptomatic of a society with serious problems, have perversely actually been celebrated as an achievement by some. Homelessness in Britain is at record levels, with people sleeping rough on the streets up and down the country, some literally within touching distance of the financial capital of the world, on the streets taunted by the shadow of the City of London. Homeless people also occupy the pavements close to Buckingham Palace, one of the greatest symbols of wealth in the entire world, worth enough money to smash poverty in Britain, but which instead exists as a snub to the poor and the downtrodden, while serving as a poignant reminder of mass entrenched widespread inequality. This tragic reality contradicts the image Britain likes to present to the world. Nurses who have acted as a real heroes in society, especially during the coronavirus pandemic, often fail to earn enough to live on without being allocated adequate pay rises. And yet, now we learn that millions of pounds will be spent to honour Prince Philip instead of compensating those who have been working on the front lines in the National Health Service, saving lives whilst risking their own lives. There are simply so many better ways in which £200 million could be spent in Britain, helping and supporting those who really need help, rather than wasting money on a flamboyant, unnecessary and pointless exercise in British nationalism. Prince Philip had enough money lavished on him during his lifetime, and he certainly does not need any more lavished on him in death, not when others who are still alive are far more deserving, plain and simple. For example, reports suggest that as Britons approach the four-year anniversary of the tragic Grenfell Tower fire, that some of those who survived and were made homeless have still not been provided or offered the right accommodation, despite government promises. Why not use some of the proposed money for the royal yacht to make good on the government promise to house those people, as former Prime Minister Theresa May promised? Plans to spend such large amounts of money on a gesture to honour Prince Philip is a powerful and sobering reminder of what the priorities of the British government and its cheerleaders really are. £200 million could have a significant impact in tackling some of the very serious problems in Britain, and could have a lasting impact on countless lives if spent elsewhere. The royal family is obscenely wealthy, and serve the function of maintaining a status quo which is seeing the gap between the most privileged and the most needy becoming greater than ever before. Healthcare, education and safeguarding the precious National Health Service, the NHS, and those that work within it should be, in an ideal world, among the government's top priorities. A team of experts has urged the British government to raise spending on social care and public health by as much as £102 billion over the next decade, funded by massive tax rises. Members of a commission of inquiry by the London School of Economics and the Lancet Medical Journal emphasised in a 123-page report published recently that the huge funding boost would reduce avoidable deaths, address health gaps, and restore the National Health Service as the COVID-19 pandemic uncovered flaws such as the shortage of beds and shortage of staff. According to the 33-member panel, the money would be funded largely by massive increases in income tax, national insurance and value-added tax VAT. In their report described as a call to action, the health experts said the funding had to increase dramatically from the current £185 billion to £288 billion by 2030-2031, with every sector getting a 4% budget uplift for each of the next 10 years. Dr. Michael Anderson of the London School of Economics, the Commission's joint research lead, said, "Without concerted action and increased funding, we risk the UK falling behind other high-income countries in health outcomes and life expectancy." Dr. Michael Anderson of London School of Economics also added that without the increase, the UK would experience continued deterioration in service provision and worsening inequalities, increased reliance on private funding, and a national health service that is poorly equipped to respond to future major threats to health. But Britons do not live in an ideal world. Britain is run by a government led by Boris Johnson, who has lurched from one crisis to another. Boris Johnson will remain loyal first and foremost, not to the people, but to himself and his own ambitions, and of course to the royal family. In keeping in line with this, his government's announcement of plans to splash out millions of pounds on a yacht which will be named after Prince Philip fits entirely with his track record so far of keeping the impoverished languishing in poverty and keeping the privileged living in a life of luxury. But despite all of this, do not expect to see crowds of people in the street opposing the plans to commemorate Prince Philip at such an expensive public price. Because the purported love of the royal family in Britain, or what some would describe as simple psychological indoctrination, runs deep and sadly remains as firm as ever. The fact that in the current social and political climate, the government feel they can brazenly get away with such an announcement concerning plans to spend millions on a royal yacht named after a prince born in Greece tells you a great deal about the reality of modern-day Britain.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio.